Let's bring in our Buster Olney on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Buster, what was the reaction around baseball yesterday to Joe West's comments?
Three things. In general, people agree with him in terms of the Red Sox and Yankees being an excruciating watch. They do feel like that they need to pick up the pace. And on Tuesday night, Angel Hernandez, who was the home plate umpire, and he's part of Joe West's crew, repeatedly denied the request from hitters to call timeout because he was like, come on, guys, let's move it along. Second thing, people were stunned that Joe West said this out loud. I would be shocked if he's not reprimanded in some way, whether it's a fine or maybe they take him off the field for a couple games. They don't want this stuff being aired out of house in the same way they don't want managers and players criticizing umpires. And number three, guys, I got a bunch of emails from players and executives saying, wait a second, Joe West is complaining about the pace of play and he's got one of the smallest strike zone in baseball. Tell Joe West to call more strikes and maybe we'll play a game under 4 hours.
I'm just amazed. And listen, I've been saying this forever. You know, I'm glad to hear a baseball guy in Keith Law say it. And Curt Schilling has jumped on him as well. Mariano Rivera had some words to say about Joe West as well. About these umpires and their egos. In either saying this, you're right, why an umpire is saying this and not, you know, if you wanted the head of the umpires wants to say something like this and make a comment, okay. But one of the umpires doing this, Greeny and I are at the Pittsburgh game yesterday, and it was Ron Culpa behind the plate, and he rung up a couple of Pittsburgh batters. One made a comment to Culpa and continued to walk away. The ump, like, was stepping toward him, and he was the one who kept mouthing off.
Well, let's really describe this scene, because this was
amazing.
I've never sat in seats like that in my entire life. After we threw out the first pitch yesterday, Buster, they put us in unbelievable seats right behind home plate. And you really do see things down there and hear things down there you don't otherwise hear. And Golic is right. Consecutive batters for the Pirates, and I want to say it was the bottom of the second inning when it was still a game.
Yeah.
Got called out on close third strike calls. And both of them said something quickly to the home plate ump and then walked away. And in both cases, we were right there.
Yeah.
The home plate ump, Ron Culpa, followed that batter and was drawing 10 times more than the batter had, and then took off his mask and was staring into the dugout.
It's unreal.
As though he was saying, come on, someone else say something, I'm ready for it. I mean, you don't see this in other
sports. Listen, you do it, and I've said, and I'm so glad to hear baseball people say it too, Buster. I'm the egos of some of these umpires, quite frankly, is embarrassing. I mean, you do not see this in other sports where they yap as much as these guys do. I swear, I do think they want the spotlight.
I do wonder if this issue with Joe West is going to spur conversation from baseball where they're basically going to remind umpires, look, you're supposed to be seen and not heard. And if you have issues going on, send it in a report. Don't talk out loud. Try to avoid confrontations with players. It's going to be something you can bet Major League Baseball will be talking about internally.
All right, Buster Olney with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Let's go around the sport a little bit. And I was reading yesterday on the flight back Jason Stark's rumblings and grumblings, and he wrote in there, it is now against the law to do a baseball column without having some Jason Hayward mentioned.
Yeah.
So perhaps we should institute that law on our program as well. Buster, thoughts on Jason Hayward?
Well, last night I talked to John Schuerholz, who's been in baseball for 46 years, and he talked about how he has never seen buzz around a young player like he's hearing around Jason Hayward right now, that he's got people in baseball with other teams coming up to him and saying, wow, look at that kid. Isn't that kid great? And it's very interesting in watching his first series how it's so clear that the Chicago Cubs were scrambling to try to figure out ways to pitch to him. You know, early on in his first at-bat, we saw Carlos Zambrano say, okay, young kid, let's see if you can handle the fastballs inside. Boom, 450-foot home run. First at-bat the next day, they try to beat him with a fastball again. Boom, a double. And now he's seeing a lot of off-speed pitches. What's going to work for him, clearly, is this unbelievable plate discipline, which really separates him from other young players, and it's the reason why you hear comparisons between he and Albert Pujols.
So early in the season, but we have one undefeated team left, San Francisco, and one team without a win at this point, and that is Houston. Other than that, what else has caught your eye that it's so early a point in the season?
The great start for Miguel Cabrera, the Tigers. You know, 7 years ago, he was baseball's Jason Hayward. You know, he had that remarkable at-bat against Roger Clemens in the World Series that year, got knocked down, then hit the opposite field home run. You know, people talked about, boy, this guy's going to have an amazing career. And he's had terrific seasons, you know, 30 homers, 110 RBI. But in the years that followed that World Series, there was always this talk of, boy, you know, it looks like he's not taking care of himself. He's gaining weight. You know, is he having off-field issues? And then that, of course, led up to last fall when he registered the .26 blood alcohol level on the final week of the season for the Tigers. He reacts to that by going in the off-season and basically cleaning up his drinking issues. And according to Cabrera, he hasn't taken a drink since then. And he, guys, is off to an unbelievable start. 8-for-14, 7 RBI, and you just wonder, has this guy really now turned the corner where we are going to see exactly how great of a player he can be? He's still a young player, and you wonder if this will be his ultimate breakout season. It's a pretty neat story for baseball.
Mike and Mike, Buster Olney, final thought, Buster. Golic's first pitch yesterday, your reaction?
So you're telling me that there is video evidence of this?
Oh, yeah, it's showing on ESPN2. Their guys are rolling it in as we described it. Golic's pitch, it's not that bad. It actually was a nice pitch he threw.
Well, and from what I hear, it's not the perfect angle. It's kind of like that 1967 Bigfoot film where it's kind of like the shaking camera. You're not exactly sure what happens. So I actually today, I think I'm going to reach out to Zach Duke of the Pirates and get confirmation that this pitch was actually a strike. I just want to let you guys know I still got to hear it from Zach Duke.
Listen, after my first two pitches, I understand that. And you're right, you didn't see it go into the catcher's mitt, but what you didn't see, it hit the dirt in front of him. And that I'm happy about. So you go ahead and confirm the story, but I threw a bullet and I threw it. Well, maybe not. I threw a strike.
He threw a strike,
and it was clocked at what velocity? Like
Faster than the president's.
Excellent.
And the vertical break was like almost an inch and a half, so he was very excited about that as well.
Congratulations, Golic.
Thanks, Robert. It's Buster Olney. Robert Stanberry Olney III.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Let's bring in Mel Kiper on that thought, draft insider extraordinaire on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Mel, I think conventional wisdom says Bradford's going number one to the Rams. Could Colt McCoy put other thoughts in their heads?
You know, guys, I think no. I would say, who do you take? And the idea of trading down's not easy. And I think that's where, again, if Washington would not have made the move to get Donovan McNabb, there was talk that Washington at 4 could move up, make that big splash, as they always seem to do, give up draft choices. They kind of disregard the draft process and eliminate that from the equation to a certain extent, move up from 4 to 1, get Bradford. St. Louis could be sitting at 4 and then look at Jimmy Clausen, who they evidently have an interest in. Billy Devaney's been kind of noncommittal here. He said, hey, we haven't decided yet. He keeps saying that as of today. And I think we have to wait and see what direction they go. Sometimes if you listen to what they're saying rather than just try to lock in what you think they definitely will do based on what you hear, sometimes it's a little different. But right now, I think you talk about conventional wisdom, guys. Bradford should go number one. Why? Because you're going to have to pay the number one guy a ton of money anyway. They've gone the defensive line route before. They've passed on Matt Ryan and Mark Sanchez in recent years. And now here's Bradford sitting there healthy and ready to go. Now, at the end of the day, and you guys know this, I gave Clausen a slightly higher grade than Bradford with Colt McCoy third. So, Jimmy Clausen's workout is today. His pro day is today. It's not like we've never seen this kid throw the ball. And he hasn't been, it's not like he's in midseason form. He is coming off an injury with the boot and all that. He will be throwing to Golden Tate and Robbie Parris and James Aldrich and Mark Trestman will be coordinating this workout. But bottom line is, it's not like we haven't seen Jimmy Clausen throw. We've seen him throw in NFL-like conditions, guys, which I think is the reason why he, I think, will end up having a more successful pro career than Sam Bradford.
So we'll see. We saw Bradford throw after an injury. Now we'll see Clausen today throw after an injury. So with that said, and you have Bradford going number one in your mock draft. So does McShay. Is there any way after the pro day today, Clausen could change the Rams' mind?
Mike, I don't think so, because you should know. And I know people say, well, they don't know. You have to know who you want. You have to know what quarterback you have a strong conviction about at this stage of the game, knowing that Bradford had his pro day. He's back from the shoulder injury. Jimmy, you know what he did at Notre Dame. You know if he was a guy that if he's back from the injury, which he will be, and like I said, he's not going to be in perfect form today. He's going to be throwing the ball, and what he wants to show is that he can drive the ball. He can make the throws that the NFL conditions force you to make, unlike coming out of spread offenses and the like with huge windows to throw into and no pressure on you from the defensive line. Jimmy's has made those throws. He's dealt with looking down that gun barrel. He's done all that with the pads, and he did it this year since September 19th, far, far, far from 100%. Everybody's coming out defending his leadership skills. So this is a kid who competes, has fire, intensity. I think he has what you want. Others have taken exception to that and said, no, he's not this, he's not that. But they've never said, guys, what he's lacking. And I think that's the issue here. They say he doesn't have the huge ceiling, doesn't have, but they've never said what Jimmy Clausen is lacking to prevent him from being a very successful NFL quarterback.
Mike and Mike, Mel Kiper is with us. One other thing I wanted you to hear. Trent Dilfer, who works for us at ESPN, mm-hmm. and I think breaks down quarterbacks in particular as well as anybody, mm-hmm. got a lot of attention this week. He was on 101 ESPN in St. Louis, the Burwell and Stelton show. Of course, in St. Louis, they're very interested. They've got the number one pick. They're asking him about Bradford. And here's what Trent Dilfer said. Listen closely.
Sam Bradford is not Mark Sanchez. He is not Matthew Stafford. He's not Matt Ryan. He's, I would say, not even Joe Flacco. Sam Bradford is a talented kid. Very, very raw. He's a very good passer, but there's major challenges ahead of him instinctively. The way he plays the position, he has not been challenged in the college game. He has not played the college game even close to what it's going to be like in the National Football League. And I'm very, very concerned what's happening here with the perception being that he's the best player in the draft and he's the no-brainer number one pick of the St. Louis Rams. I think that could be a catastrophic mistake for the Rams if he's not handled properly if they do indeed draft him.
So that was Trent. He used, mm-hmm. he got a lot of attention for using the word catastrophic mistake if they make him the number one pick. Mel, what did you think of that analysis of Bradford as a prospect?
Well, Trent and I have spoken a lot. We've been on the clocks together since early March. I was back 2 months ago with Clausen, obviously locked in through 3 months ago. We talked about this all year, how I like Clausen. So, Trent, I think, is saying that, okay, there's certain things that Sam Bradford needs to do at the pro level. He hasn't proven he can do at the college level. That's a given. What it's going to take is some time. And I think that's where quarterbacks now are given no time. They're expected by game six or right away game one to be the guy, as the last four have been to a certain extent. So I think you look at that force feeding that goes on, normally it would be like it is in Philadelphia, where Kevin Cobb is textbook on how you develop the quarterback in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Okay, now we're in this era where, hey, it's immediate. And I think what Trent's saying is Sam Bradford right now is not ready to be a starting quarterback. How long will it take him to learn and gain the knowledge and feel comfortable dealing with all the things he didn't have to deal with at Oklahoma? Who knows? There's that question. That's why I've said all along, and I think when you look at it right now, the way the situation is in the NFL, Jimmy Clausen makes more sense with the way this era is with quarterbacks. And I think that's why, I put him ahead of Bradford, and I think Trent did. Trent's also very high on Colt McCoy. I like Colt McCoy a lot. I think he's going to go late first, early second round. So I think we're in agreement. I'm not as strong about Bradford. I think Bradford will be a very good quarterback. I think he'll be an excellent quarterback, but it may a little bit of time, which unfortunately in the NFL, we're not very patient these days with quarterbacks.
And we are getting impatient for the draft. It's 2 weeks from yesterday, Thursday night, the 22nd, prime time will be the first round. You will see it on ESPN, and certainly you'll be seeing a whole lot of Mel Kiper Jr. We'll talk to you later, Mel. Thank you.
You got it, guys. Have a good weekend.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Today, the course is somewhat receptive to me, and hit some good shots. And through the middle of the round, I got the ball up and down, six straight holes, and it's Watson Wolf.
Little Tom Watson magic yesterday, as he is right in the thick of things, as he was less than a year ago at the British Open. We're Mike and Mike in the Morning after an amazing first day at the Masters. Tiger Woods certainly getting all of the attention, shooting a 68 and looking awfully good in doing it. But Fred Couples at the age of 50 was better. Tom Watson at the age of 60 was better. Phil Mickelson, the game's second biggest star, right in the mix as well. Let's go back live to Augusta now, bring in two-time U.S. Open champion, our own Andy North. And so, Andy, before we get to Tiger, and certainly we will, let's start with your close friend, Tom Watson, and whether or not this, the second biggest story at the Masters, has a chance to have legs throughout the weekend.
Well, you never count out guys that are playing golf courses they really enjoy and they've had great success on. And obviously, watching Tom play golf over the last few years, he still hits the ball exceptionally well. But this is a little different story than last summer. The golf course last summer, Turnberry, was a very fast golf course that it was all about ball striking and not so much distance. Well, Augusta National is still distance, and Tom played exceptionally well Thursday. And he would even admit it that, yeah, it was tied his best round ever there. But at the same time, the golf course it will be played longer on Friday. The hole location probably will be more difficult. I expect him to play well. I just don't know if he can keep up what he's doing.
Okay, so let's move past the 6-year-old and go to the 50-year-old in Fred Couples, who has the lead of the Masters right now. How does he hold up as the course plays longer?
Well, I thought before the week started that Freddie had a great chance to win this tournament. I mean, he's been playing unbelievably well. You look at the numbers he's been throwing up there. He is shooting some scores that are amazing, 62s and 64s, and you know, some of those funny numbers that you just dream about. He's putting better than he's putted in ages. He has still great length. I think the one thing you have to it's been interesting to look at. If you're out there gathering and you watch Fred Couples' group come through or Tom Watson's group come through, they don't look like old men out there playing golf. They look like just another guy in a threesome playing. And I think that's the difference in today's older players, that these guys are still in really great shape. They have continued playing golf because of the Champions Tour, and they're very, very competitive.
Andy North with us live from Augusta on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Let's get to Phil Mickelson, who putted extremely well yesterday, has had a lot of success at Augusta, played very well last year. Remember that thrilling final round where he and Tiger were paired together and actually shot a better number that day than Tiger did. What did you see from Mickelson yesterday?
Well, Phil looks so comfortable on this golf course. He even mentioned that in his interviews afterwards, that he comes here and he just relaxes more than he does any place else. The golf course fits his style beautifully. He's playing well. The one question so far this year is why he hasn't been as consistent as he needs to have won tournaments. He's played some very, very good golf. I expect as this week goes on, he'll stay right there, and he's putting well and has tons of confidence.
And then as, you know, we get to Tiger Woods, a guy who shot his best first round ever at the Masters and has four jackets. What did you think of how he started, how the nerves may have been early on, and how he played his round?
I think one thing that I always watch closely in Tiger is the rhythm of his golf swing. On the practice range, there's never been anybody that hits it any better than he does. It's just amazing. He never misses a shot. His rhythm and speed of his golf swing is just fabulous. And then quite often he goes to the golf course and just gets amped up just enough that rhythm changes enough that he's able to hit some shots offline. Well, yesterday I thought going to the first tee, the reception he received at the first tee was so heartwarming, and he responded to it so positively that he just walked up there and hit this perfect tee shot. And I think that really settled him down and really got him into his round right away.
Mike and Mike, Andy North is with us. We had Tom Rinaldi with us earlier this morning, Andy, who walked the course with Tiger yesterday. And I asked him this question. I'll ask it to you. You've been going to Augusta at the Masters, playing and covering for many, many years. If you hadn't known that something unusual was going on with Tiger Woods yesterday, would you have known anything unusual was going on?
No. I mean, once he got to the first tee and was off, it looked like just a normal round of golf at a major championship for Tiger. He looked very relaxed. I thought that he responded really well to the patrons all day long. He hit a lot of quality golf shots. I thought it just looked like he just fell right back into what he does, and that's be the best player in the world.
So how do we expect today to turn out as the pin placement moves, as the course becomes a little longer with some of these players?
Well, I think one thing that will definitely change, yesterday they had the tees up a bit on all the par fives, and as you saw, a lot of guys reach these greens in two. We saw a bunch of eagles. I think that will be the biggest change today, that they'll have the tees back a little bit, and only the longest guys will be hitting on these greens. I mean, Tiger hit it on three of the four par fives with irons yesterday and had a chance to hit it on the other one. So it's going to be an interesting day. There's a little bit of breeze, as there always is here. It's a little bit cooler, but the golf course wasn't affected much by the overnight rains. I think you're going to see some good scoring again, and it'll be interesting if it dries out and it firms up. One thing yesterday, that the greens stayed very receptive the entire day. They started off soft enough you could really spin the ball, and they basically stayed that way because of the overcast and a little bit of drizzle later on. So it was a great day for scoring yesterday. I would think it'd be a little bit more difficult today.
Mike and Mike, Andy North is with us, and with all of those huge names, Tiger at the top, and then Watson and Couples and Mickelson, no one else is getting any attention today, but there were a lot of guys who shot very good numbers. Who else were you particularly impressed with yesterday that made you say, okay, watch out for this guy as the weekend goes on?
Well, I'm not so sure looking forward as much, but Ricky Barnes, who played well in the U.S. Open last year, that really hasn't played a lot of quality golf other than that, and now he's back in a major championship and playing really well. KJ Choi, Yang. I mean, there were so many good rounds of golf yesterday. It was a lot of fun to watch, and if this was your first Masters and you're out there walking around watching this thing, my, this is pretty cool. I think you'd be pretty blown away by what a great day it was.
How about the other side of it? How about guys you expected to be doing a little better and they're, you know, not doing so well on the leaderboard?
Well, I was very, very surprised with Jim Furyk. Jim has been playing just great. He's prepared well for this, and he went out and had just a bad day at the wrong time yesterday. That's the kind of guy that you always think will be a top 10 finisher in a major, and he obviously didn't have one of his better days.
Well, for those who don't know, he didn't break 80 yesterday. How do you explain something like that? You've played the game a long time. Those of us who play it as hackers, we certainly understand having a terrible day. But a guy who is genuinely one of the best players in the world, explain how that happens, Andy, that a guy go out there and just have a day that bad.
Well, I mean, there are days that your body just doesn't respond very well. You wake up and you feel different. Maybe there's swelling in your hands or you haven't slept. There's so many things that work in the negative. And this is a golf course. If you get going poorly on it, and we see all these wonderful shots and these birdies, but this is a golf course. If, for example, the 15th hole where the pin was yesterday, you play a shot in there and it comes up 1 foot short of the green, you spin it back in the water, and all of a sudden you make a seven. The 16th hole yesterday, Jim Furyk hit two balls in that pond. Well, the water's only 15 feet left of the hole. You pull it a little bit, you end up making a big score. So it's just one of those situations that you get it going poorly, and there are just some days you can't turn it back around, and nothing goes right, and you add it up at the end of the day, and you can't believe what you've shot.
It was certainly a very interesting first day at the Masters. Andy North, a huge part of ESPN's coverage, which continues today. Live coverage, 4 o'clock Eastern, 3 Central on ESPN and ESPN3.com. SportsCenter updates throughout the day as Tiger Woods gets started in about 2 hours. And, Andy, let's talk Monday morning when we have a champion. Thank you.
You got it, guys. Have a great weekend.
There's our buddy Andy North.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Is the coach John Calipari back with us on Mike and Mike? How are you, Coach?
Good, Mike. How are you?
Well, we're well. And what was that like? Just sort of looking back on the year again, I know it was a disappointing ending against West Virginia, and you wanted that team to get to the Final Four and take a few more steps. But having such high expectations with such incredibly young players and then playing as well as they did and your team did, what was that like?
Well, I had a ball coaching them. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. At times, it was like coaching eighth graders because we were so young, but they were a ball to coach. We won 35 games. We took everyone's best shot. We didn't play before an empty seat in any arena that we played in. You know, we were the Super Bowl for every team we played. And we hit that one game to go 0-for-20 from the three-point line. And you got to accept, you know, Coach Thompson came up to me at the Final Four and said, my best team did not win the national title. And it happens in this one and done. But I'll say this, I'm proud. You know, it's kind of like being a father. You're teaching, you're working, and you're sad to see them go, but you're proud of them. We just lost four freshmen. Four. And, you know, you talk about Eric Bledsoe wasn't thought of as going to be a one and done, or Daniel Orton, who did not play his senior year in high school because of a knee injury. Even DeMarcus Cousins, more emotionally than as a player, but they came around. John Wall was always thought of, but he's changed his game, and now all of a sudden becomes that guy everybody covets. So Patrick Patterson changed his position and goes from a center to a wing, and all of a sudden, he's now a lottery pick. I'm proud of him, yet I wish they were staying for two more years.
Well yeah, and years ago, talk about how different it is, because years ago when you see freshmen out there playing and they make a mistake, you're like, well, you know, something we can work on for the next year or the year after. You're coaching these guys, especially Wall and Cousins, thinking, I got them for 1 year, so I got to make hay while I got them here.
And let me say this. I don't agree with the rule now. I think that, one, kids should be able to go directly to the league if that's what they choose to do. And if they go to college, they should stay 2 years or maybe three. The way it is right now, it's really hard. I mean, you think about my team next year. I'm going to coach all freshmen again next year. The team I have, which will be next year, I'll have
four returning players who have some experience, two have experience, two have not much experience, and then you're going to have two returning players. The rest are going to be freshmen, but that's the way it is. Our system of play, we can do that. I mean, dribble drive and what we're teaching when they get it, and it usually takes till the end of January, February. When they get it, they can really play unleashed, which helps them, but it's hard.
Mike and Mike, John Calipari, coach of Kentucky. Quickly, one thing that we were talking about all week here, and we had Coach K on, and he explained it. When you saw in the last 3 seconds of the championship game, when you saw Mike Krzyzewski intentionally miss a free throw that would have given his team a 3-point lead, a quote-unquote invulnerable lead in regulation with 3 seconds left, what went through your mind? Give us, from a coach's standpoint, a thought on the strategy.
Well, I've done it before. We had 1.8 seconds to go at Tennessee a couple years ago. And how about this? And they had a timeout.
Yeah.
I figured they'd have 1 second to go, and we'd be fine. I told the kid to miss it. He looked at me. He said, what are you talking about? I said, miss it. He said, coach. I said, miss it. And they threw a ball toward half court and got a heave. What you're saying is the best they're going to do is a heave. And if you lose that way, you know, it's kind of like your fate was working against you. So, you know, I agree with what he did. But if that shot went in, it would have been the wrong move. See, that's what is, it's funny. You know, we played Kansas, and we missed those free throws. They made every shot. It comes down to do you foul or not. We're going to foul at half court because there's 11 seconds to go. The kid gets away from my point guard. He doesn't foul. The kid makes a contested three. If he missed that three, they would have said, Cal did a good thing not fouling. Well, we were trying to foul. And if he made that shot, it would have been, why didn't he foul in the backcourt? Well, because we can't make free throws. When you're coaching, whatever you do, if it works, it was right. And if it doesn't work, you were wrong. And guys like two talking heads on ESPN, these Mike and Mike guys, will dissect it and say, you shouldn't, why'd he do that? It's just coaching.
It's even worse. I was critical of the move, and it worked.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand it, and he won the championship. Mike and Mike and John Calipari, who is helping raise a lot of money for the University of Kentucky Symphony Orchestra, which is terrific, not just involved in sports, but involved in other activities that students outside of athletes, like myself, can be involved in and enjoy. Explain that.
Well, the Maker's Mark came at me to do a bottle with my big nose face on it, and you can't believe it looks like a nose on the front of the bottle. And they painted the bottle's all blue, and they did the bottle, and they're going to raise like $350,000. I'm at Keeneland right now. I got to sign bottles for 2 hours on a recruiting day, which is crazy, but I'm going to do it. And they've also given another 8,000 bottles that you can go to the CalipariFoundation.org and order these bottles, and that money's going to the Children's Foundation. So there's some money being raised, which is a good thing. They're using my ugly, I'm telling you, my nose is so big on this bottle, you cannot believe it. But it's, you know, but it's a good thing. And I think that, you know, our university, our orchestra, and what they're going to do, they're going to go out and take the orchestra around our state and try to turn young people onto music. Is that a great thing?
It is.
Let's take it out and go different parts of our state. And our state's a poor state. I mean, Kentucky's not one of those states where, you know, kids have access to those kind of things or instruments and all that. So this is a really good thing. And if people want to get involved, they can go to CalipariFoundation.org and order these bottles on the internet too.
Good for you. Coach, enjoy your spring. Thanks for the time. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Coach.
See you guys.